This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, June 20, 2002. I'm Deepa Fernandez at Pacifica Station KPFA in Berkeley, California. In a big victory for anti-death penalty advocates, the Supreme Court rules that executing mentally retarded people is unconstitutional. The City Council of New York hears the case for reparations for the descendants of slaves. And major street protests call for Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo to resign after he sold off electricity companies to foreign interests. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The U.S. Supreme Court ruled today that it is cruel and unusual punishment to execute the mentally retarded. Ellen Ratner reports from D.C.
In a 6-3 decision, the Supreme Court ruled that subjecting the mentally retarded to capital punishment is a violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition of cruel and unusual punishment. The defendant, Daryl Atkins, was sentenced to death by the state of Virginia, even though his IQ is only 59 and he has always lived under someone else's supervision. The decision reverses a 1989 ruling that executing the mentally ill is legal. In today's decision, dissenting judges Rehnquist, Scalia, and Thomas claimed that the symptoms of retardation could be feigned, an opinion Doreen Crozer of the American Association of Mental Retardation found totally inadequate.
Deficits in adaptive behavior, that there's usually a history of special education or school failure.
18 states currently forbid executing the mentally retarded. Today's case sets a national precedent which would prevent such executions from taking place. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Ellen Ratner in Washington, D.C.
We'll have more on that story coming up. The U.S. Senate has, for the first time since 1988, discussed impediments to union participation in the United States. Gareth Schweitzer has more from the Capitol.
Today's contentious hearing, the first discussing the freedom of workers to associate since 1988, was attended by large numbers of vocal union members and representatives. Only one Republican senator was present at the hearing, leaving Democrats to dominate the discussion of illegal firings and weak penalties imposed against employers. Democrat Ted Kennedy detailed how widespread these problems have become.
Despite our great labor traditions, it is extraordinary how commonplace illegal employer tactics have become when workers attempt to form unions. Each year, employers unlawfully discriminate against more than 20,000 workers just for exercising their basic rights in the workplace.
Noting a Republican-controlled House of Representatives that would be hostile to any reform, AFL-CIO Legislative Director Bill Samuel believes that labor must begin by informing the public about corporate abuses of workers' rights, as well as the higher wages and better benefits accrued by union members. For Free Speech Radio News at the Capitol, I'm Gareth Schweitzer.
U.S. diplomatic and economic officials admitted today that the boycott of U.S. goods by Arab nations has led to a sharp loss of exports to ally Saudi Arabia. Government estimates show that the U.S. now sells 33% less to Saudi consumers. U.S. embassy officials in Saudi Arabia said they would study the loss, but believe it may be more in line with the increasing value of the dollar and decreasing defense contracts. The campaign against U.S. goods began after a September 2000 Palestinian uprising and has intensified since the large-scale Israeli offensive in the occupied territories in March of this year. Japanese and French officials have confirmed that their exports to Saudi Arabia have increased dramatically in 2002. A general strike in Spain has practically shut down everything, from coffee shops to markets and neighborhoods throughout the country. David Oancia explains why from Madrid.
Union leaders led massive demonstrations through Seville, the city of Vigo, in Madrid. The strike, which had been called by the unions after the government announced drastic changes to unemployment benefits, coincided with the end of President Aznar's EU presidency and the European summit in Seville. As a result, it was a major embarrassment for them. In Andalusia, the strike actually shut down all the airports, forcing the cancellation of many summit events scheduled tomorrow morning because not all the leaders were able to fly into the country. For Free Speech Radio News, this is David Oancia in Madrid.
Finally, the U.S. Justice Department has sued the New York City Parks Department for discriminating against African Americans and Hispanics when hiring managers and deciding on promotions. Willie Perdono reports from New York.
Manhattan U.S. Attorney James Comey sued the New York City Parks Department in federal court, saying the agency discriminates against black and Latino workers. The suit, which follows a September 1999 probe, accuses the agency of promoting white workers while avoiding the promotion of black and Latino workers. The city's Parks Department operates more than 1,700 parks, and nearly half of the department's 2,000 workers are black or Hispanic. But prosecutors charge those workers aren't getting promoted. Prosecutors say they want to defend the employees' right of equal opportunity in the public workplace. The Parks Department states it follows promotional guidelines at the highest level and denies the charges. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Willie Perdomo in New York.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
A divided Supreme Court reversed course today and ruled that executing mentally retarded people is unconstitutionally cruel, giving scores of inmates on death row the possibility of a reprieve. The most immediate effect of the ruling will be in the 20 states that allow execution of retarded people. Dozens or perhaps hundreds of inmates in those states will likely now argue that they are retarded and that their sentences should be converted to life in prison. Mitch Perry reports from Tampa.
The court ruled in favor of a Virginia inmate, Daryl Renard Atkins, who was convicted of shooting an Air Force enlisted man for beer money in 1996. Atkins's lawyers say he has an IQ of 59 and has never lived on his own or held a job. In the future, the ruling will mean that people arrested for a killing will not face a potential death sentence if they can show they are retarded, generally defined as having an IQ of 70 or lower. Brenda Bowser is from the Death Penalty Information Center. She calls this move a landmark decision.
I mean, I think it's fairly accurate to categorize this as a landmark ruling. We've seen over the past several years a growing national consensus against the execution of those with mentally retarded. Certainly public opinion and state legislative movement has been going in that direction. And I think that there's no doubt that the court is reflecting that. And so while concerns remain perhaps about other parts of the death penalty, today was a significant step forward in ending a practice that the vast majority of Americans and certainly our allies around the world view as abhorrent.
Stephen Hawkins is executive director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. He says the Supreme Court clearly took note of what the states have been doing.
In Justice Stevens' opinion, he notes that just in 2000 and 2001 alone, in the last 2 years, six states, ranging from South Dakota to North Carolina, banned the use of the death penalty against persons with mental retardation, and that added to the 12 states that had done it earlier in the 90s.
The court decided 6-3, with the conservative contingent of Chief Justice William Rehnquist joining Justices Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas in dissenting. In his written dissent, Rehnquist wrote that the majority put too much stock in opinion polls and the views of national and international observers. As Brenda Bowser from the Death Penalty Information Center says, when the High Court ruled on such executions in 1989, only two states that use capital punishment outlawed the practice for the retarded. Now, 18 states prohibit it.
The court itself in 1989 in the Penry case said that a national consensus had not developed against this practice, and that was part of its reasoning for not ending it at that time. And I think that it's obvious that since that time we've seen that consensus develop where you have 30 of the 50 states that either do not execute mentally retarded or don't have the death penalty at all. And the court certainly reflected that in today's decision. And so I think that, you know, in 89, certainly they relied on the national consensus, and they've done that again today.
Florida is one of those states that banned executing the mentally retarded just in the past year. Abe Bonovitz from the advocacy group Floridians Against the Death Penalty says a key determinant now will be who says who is mentally retarded.
The interesting thing is that what they did say is they didn't set a specific standard for what is mentally retarded. They left that open to interpretation and established the guideline that mental retardation professionals would evaluate and comment or report their findings at the sentencing stage of a case.
Mitch Perry, Free Speech Radio News, Tampa.
Israeli troops have now entered the West Bank city of Bethlehem, the adjacent Dehesha refugee camp, and Beitonia, just outside of Ramallah. They've been in the cities of Jenin and Qalqilah since Tuesday night. The army said troops are carrying out searches, they've imposed curfews and made a number of arrests. This as Yasser Arafat demanded an end to Palestinian attacks on Israeli civilians. And as our correspondent in Ramallah, Awad Duwabez, reports, it comes amidst the most intense grassroots pressure against suicide bombings by Palestinians in the occupied territories.
In the largest statement of its kind to date, over 200 lawyers, university professors, politicians, intellectuals and journalists published an appeal in the largest daily Palestinian newspaper condemning and calling for a halt of suicide bombings in Israel. The signatures are trying themselves to understand and look for a solution to this situation. Jalal Qadr, a private lawyer in Ramallah and one of those who signed the appeal.
I think the Intifada began as a non-violent act, but we were faced by real bullets. And the reaction of Israel was very hard and very cruel towards pacifists or towards manifestations that we do as non-violent action. And I think the media in the United States or in Europe is not helping to cover well the non-violent action to attract their audience.
Others among those who were behind this move are opposing the suicide bombings in principle for moral and humanitarian reasons. Nazmi Al-Jabi, a professor in Birzeit University and one of the organizers of this appeal.
We think that the Israeli occupation led to lose or to oblige us to lose part of our human character. And I think we have to save our manners, our humanity, and not to be led by the occupation all the time, and the occupation will turn not just our life into impossible, but it will turn our interior life and our thinking into a form of unhuman.
In the appeal that is ongoing and having more and more names and supporters within the Palestinian society, several points are raised. They rejected the suicide attacks that legitimized the Israeli continuous war led by Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon. They say the attacks had done nothing to advance Palestinian cause and that they are making it harder to reach an agreement and live in peace in two states, Israel and Palestine. Such speech is launching indeed a great debate that other players are saying it might harm the Palestinian unity. Yet, this is not the point of view of the organizers of this campaign, according to Nazmi Al-Jabi.
I think the political future of Palestine is not owned by anybody. It is owned by the majority of our society. And the majority of the Palestinians are looking for peace and for stability and for normal life. And it is our full right, regardless to the Hamas or the Jihad Islami or the PFLP or the FLP position. We have our own position. We are Palestinians and we are living in this land, so we can formulate and we have the full right to formulate our position.
Last night, Yasser Arafat addressed the Palestinian people publicly and asked them to stop each single attack against Israeli civilians. For the first time, Arafat said that the suicide bombings in Israel are far away of being a part of what he called our legitimate right to resist the Israeli occupation. The alternative of the suicide bombings asked by the population and given by Yasser Arafat has been also adapted by those who signed the appeal, as explains Jalal Khadr.
This kind of operations is hurting our political struggle for having an independent state in Palestine. When it's more hurting our political aims, we have to think about other kind of struggle. It might be negotiations, it might be political, it might be inside the occupied land, but never we accepted in civilian society in Israel.
On the ground, the situation is not that simple. Israeli forces reoccupied the cities of Tulkarem, Qalqilah, Jenin, Nablus, and Israeli sources are talking about a new Israeli long occupation of Ramallah in the coming hours, that might be for 1 or even 2 months. Our Dedaib is reporting for Free Speech Radio News, Ramallah.
Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo is walking a fine line today as calls for his resignation grow in Peru after he sold off 2 major electricity companies to a Belgian-French corporation. Peruvians took to the streets in many southern towns to protest the already deeply unpopular Toledo, who they say lied by privatizing the power generators despite signing a pledge not to sell while campaigning for last year's elections.
I think that there have been many mistakes made by the Toledo regime in these last weeks in his relation with common citizens in all this region of Peru.
Executive Secretary of the National Association of Human Rights Organizations, Francisco Soberón, speaking from the southern Peruvian city of Arequipa, which has been the scene of major protests this past week that saw Peruvian President Alejandro Toledo declare martial law, which brought clashes in which one student died and hundreds were injured. Over 1,000 soldiers armed with automatic rifles moved into the city earlier this week, backed by light armored vehicles and over 1,000 police officers equipped with riot helmets and shields. People in Arequipa and other southern cities took to the streets en masse because they were angry that very little effort was made to talk to their local officials and try and work out an agreement that all parties would be happy with in relation to the selling of the electricity companies. Soberón, who was in the streets for much of the week-long protests, says Toledo's actions too closely replicate those of previous authoritarian president Alberto Fujimori, and Peruvians are not willing to take this from Toledo.
People in the streets are very upset against the Toledo regime and their Toledo behavior. They are saying that there was no difference in terms of authoritarianism and how he behaved with citizens, not accomplish his promises.
Coletta Youngers, a senior associate at the Washington office on Latin America, says that the privatization attempt sparked these massive protests largely because the widespread privatization that took place under the Fujimori regime brought extreme poverty to so many. She says that people were worried that their electricity bills were going to go up much more than they could afford to pay and that there would be massive job losses.
Basically, what you have at play here is the contrast between what people want, what Toledo promised he would do during his campaign, and the reality of the free market economic approach that the government has put into place. Privatizations are seen as essential, one, to fill the government coffers so that they can carry out other programs, and two, because it's the linchpin of the Toledo government's efforts to attract private investment into the country. And there was a feeling on the part of his principal economic advisors that if he backed down on this privatization, it would send a wrong message to the international community.
Youngers says it's a classic case where the reality of poor people's lives directly clashes with global economic interests. She says that since Toledo has assumed power, he has courted the world's big money interests at the expense of the social well-being of the majority of Peruvians. So much so that these privatizations have really put his presidency at stake. And yesterday, civil society leaders, the town's mayors, and an NGO mission finally signed the Arequipa Declaration to accept that a Peruvian judiciary would decide on the all-but-completed privatization deal. This immediately suspended the government's plans for privatization. And as a result, the country's interior minister, Fernando Rospiglioso, resigned late yesterday, and many expect the Minister of Justice, Fernando Rivera, to resign today. President Toledo is himself walking a fine line right now. Coletta Youngers again.
He promised a lot in his campaign that he was not able to deliver. Second, the economy, while it has done well in terms of overall growth rates, there has been no trickle down. There are more people living in absolute poverty now than was the case when Toledo took office. The economic situation is just desperate for a lot of people, for the bulk of the Peruvian population. And third, the Toledo government has been plagued with mismanagement and poor communication. It has not done a good job of really trying to work with community groups, with the government, on these big issues related to the overall economic program like privatization. And as a result, has faced a lot of opposition for policies that aren't very popular in Peru.
Martial law ended with the signing of the Arequipa Declaration, and many are calling for a full investigation into the death and injury caused by what Soberón's Human Rights Association says were gas bombs thrown by the police. France's best-known Roquefort cheese producer José Bové is in jail today, and he's refused to take food until France's national holiday on the 14th of July to encourage protests against global capitalism. Tony Cross reports from Paris.
Bové arrived at the prison yesterday riding a tractor and wearing a prisoner's uniform. 400 supporters, many of them also driving tractors, accompanied him to the jail at Villeneuve-les-Maguelones in the south of France, near the scene of the crime he perpetrated in 1999. Bové faces 3 months in jail for his part in a protest which dismantled a McDonald's, which was under construction at Millau, as a protest against the multinationals' domination of the world's diet and its alleged use of animal-based cattle feed. The 9 other people found guilty with him, who don't face jail at the moment, symbolically chained themselves to Bové and demanded to be locked up as well. Bové, whose spokesperson for the small farmers' union Confédération Paysanne, said that he's being punished as a representative of a worldwide protest movement.
When we took the McDonald's to pieces, there were 400 of us. It wasn't an individual act. It was on behalf of the Confédération Paysanne and the whole citizens' movement. So the entire citizens' movement is being put in jail when they imprison me.
An appeal court judge in April postponed Bové's jailing until after the recent elections, which returned right-wing President Jacques Chirac and then gave France a right-wing government. But Bové's lawyer, François Roux, still put the blame on new Prime Minister Jean-Pierre Raffarin's administration.
It looks like a provocation by the new government to want to put José Bové in prison when, in a few weeks' time, if things go according to form, there will be an amnesty, as there is after every presidential election, and crimes related to trade union activity are usually amnestied. You'd think that the new government would have more urgent things to do than to imprison José Bové. His lawyers have always said that he has no place in jail.
Left-wingers from France's Green and Communist parties have condemned the jailings, and there have been small protests in provincial towns. Speaking at yesterday's rally outside the jail, lawyer François Roux said that Bové is now going to stop taking food to muster support for the protest movement.
Mr. Bové has announced that he will refuse food from today until the 14th of July in the way that Gandhi used to do. He hopes that this fast will allow the protest movement to get together and organize so as to explain the legitimacy of the demands of this broad movement, which, as you know, meets every year at the big conference in Porto Alegre.
José Bové's lawyer, François Roux. Bové has already served 20 days of his sentence in between appeals, but he clearly doesn't intend to stay quiet during the rest of his spell in jail. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Tony Cross in Paris.
For the first time in history, the City Council of New York held hearings on reparations and restitution for the descendants of Americans held in bondage in the Empire State. African-American historians, political and social leaders, lawyers and activists all spoke before the council. Yesterday's hearings coincided with the historic day of Juneteenth, the day when enslaved Africans in Galveston, Texas, were belatedly informed of their freedom. Dred Scott Keyes was at the hearings and files this report.
The 3 resolutions being considered by the committee call for the creation of a city-sponsored commission to study the reparations issue, the creation of a Reparations Awareness Day, and support of a lawsuit against corporations which supported the system of slavery. Councilmember Charles Barron introduced City Council Resolutions 41, 92, and 217.
Once those resolutions are submitted to the floor of the City Council, then they get assigned to committees. Committee has to hold hearings on it. Fortunately for me, my resolutions were submitted to Bill Perkins, Councilmember Bill Perkins' Committee on Government Operations, and that's why we got the hearing. The purpose of the hearings is so we can get these resolutions passed from the committee and then go to the full council and have a commission set up on reparations funded by New York City to stay out for a specific amount of time, 1 year, and to come back and recommend compensation for the enslavement of the African here in New York City from 1625, when New York was New Amsterdam, to 1827, when the English had taken over in 1664 and called it New York.
Among those testifying before the committee was New York State Assembly member Roger Green from Brooklyn. He says that many people have a misconception about the history of New York because of its northern location.
New York State was the center of the heaviest slaveholding region north of the Mason-Dixon line. The number of slaves in New York State grew to some 21,324 enslaved African human beings by the year 1790, and this was according to the U.S. Census, thanks to the Congress of the United States. This figure was 7,000 short of the total number of enslaved Africans that were held captive in the state of Georgia during that same period.
I'm DeAdria Farmer Pellman, and I am a plaintiff in a class action lawsuit filed for reparations from corporations.
Farmer Pellman is one of the litigants in a suit against corporations that profited by the buying, trading, and selling of human beings. In 1997, as a law student, she began approaching guilty corporations for apologies, restitution, and reparations. One of the corporations named in the lawsuit is the Wall Street firm of Brown Brothers Harriman & Company, the largest private bank in the country. She says the company served as a clearinghouse for the South's complex financial system.
The firm earned commissions arranging cotton shipments from southern ports to mills in New England and Britain. It also loaned millions directly to planters, merchants, and cotton brokers throughout the South. Company records also revealed that Brown Brothers loaned to plantation owners who told the firm that they needed the cash to buy slaves. When those planters or their banks failed, it used its local agents to run repossessed plantations and manage the enslaved Africans working there. In other words, they became slave owners.
The hearings became contentious at one point when council member Peter Vallone Jr., who neither supports the creation of a commission or the idea of reparations, squared off with Congress member John Conyers, who was also testifying before the august body.
If his opposition is because of the expenditures, then let us all examine the expenditures. I mean, is this going to cost $1 billion? Is it going to cost $1 million? What is it going to cost? And of course, I have a long list of federal expenditures, which all of you have contributed to, that go into the billions for ships that won't float, planes that won't fly, projects that stagger the imagination of science, and also projects that are given to the military when they don't even want them.
Congressman, I know you tried to stick up for me on the financial point, but I do want to clarify. I was opposed to the commission from a financial aspect. I am opposed to reparations on a foundational level. You just mentioned that governments and corporations should be held accountable. Governments are made up of people. Corporations are made up of shareholders. None who exist today who have done anything wrong.
The committee adjourned without voting on the resolutions, promising to hold one more hearing before a vote will take place. State Assembly Member Roger Green and Congress Member John Conyers have introduced similar legislation on the state and national levels. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Dred Scott Keyes.
When will we be paid for the work we've done? When will we be paid for the work we've done?
Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica Stations KPFA in Berkeley and WBAI in New York and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. The newscast is produced by Aaron Glantz, headlines editor Randy Zimmerman, technical producer Jade Paget-Seekins. We have technical assistance from Kata Mesta and Nell Geiser, web support from Vanessa Tate. Our interns are Rosalind Fay, Susan Chelli, Rich Kim, Fernando Romero, Christopher Martinez, and William Perdomo. I'm Deepa Fernandez.
We've been beat up, called names, shot down and stoned. Oh, no.